Gluttons for Punishment, you're back with If I Speak. I feel like we should come up with an audience name, because at the moment it's If I Speakers. So if you have any suggestions, can you send the audience names to ifispeak@navarramedia.com? You can also send dilemmas there along with hopes, dreams.
I've got it.
Winning lottery tickets. Yeah, we've got it. Go on.
Okay, the name for the audience is... So the backstory of our name is, of course, the iconic Jose Mourinho meme, right? So I prefer not to speak. If I speak, I am in big trouble. So we call our audience the special ones.
I love that. Although I feel like lots of our audience won't get that. The special ones. And thing is, okay, if audience, you like that name, send in or tell us on social media or something like that. I might even do a poll. But if you think we need an organic name invented by you and we can't foist a name top down on you, tell us that too. Because we want to do this in a way that's conducive to our politics, you know? So maybe we need like a grassroots committee name. Anyway, today on If I Speak, I've got Ash Sarkar with me. Ash, vibe check.
I actually feel really excited at the moment because in preparation for the icebreaker questions, it made me consider some of my favourite things in the world. And that made me really happy.
Oh, then I'll definitely be flipping every single one of them round on you to find out what the story behind the questions. As you segued so beautifully there, I may as well ride the wave. What are your icebreaker questions? Go on, give them to me.
Okay. It is time for our traditional icebreaker, Vogue's 73 questions minus 70, which means there's three questions because we don't have the time or the intellectual property rights. So question one, money and feasibility, no object. What's your dream home like?
Oh, do you know what's so funny? People ask me this quite a lot. It's a question that comes up among my generation. And I can honestly say, I think because I'm bad at visualizing things, maybe it's ADHD, because I'm bad at visualizing things.
Maybe she's born with it.
Maybe she's neurodivergent. Maybe her traits are just exacerbated by the attention economy we live in. So now she has a diagnosis that might not have been given 20 years ago. Anyway, either way, I'm bad at visualizing stuff. So it's quite difficult. And a lot of homes I walk by, I'm like, I'd live there because any home that looks like secure and big is nice. I think I'm going to nick one from my friend, Annie Lord. We were talking the other day about those big, beautiful, like open plan warehouse flats that you can get in maybe like Limehouse. Those, you know, used to be warehouses for the docks and are now one of those top floor ones that you get to look at and everything. I think that's gorgeous. I love just like a big Victorian house with bay windows. I think that'd be fine too. But I also like one of the flats I lived in, where I was very lucky to live, that was in Kennington. And it was just like an old, it was council housing, but it was the beautiful old council housing made in like the 1920s or something. And it was like the taupe blocks, but not how they're done now, but just one of those, you know, beautiful balcony, public communal garden at the back, top floor. I quite like a top floor. And I'd love a house where I can have eaves in a little attic room. Any eaves for me would be great, but I don't have a specific outline of my dream home. And I also come from, I think because I come from paradise. So where I grew up was literally, it's more about like the garden and the surroundings of the community for me than the actual, I guess, the home. The house I live in now is really nice. I'd be happy to live here forever, for example. But it's like where it's situated was also so key for me. I once lived in an absolute hovel in Dalston, but I was so happy because it was had everything I needed and wanted on my doorstep. I don't know, what's your dream house? And are you in it?
I really love the house that I'm in because it's a Victorian terrace house and that just feels very, very London and I love it. If we're doing the whole like money, no object, fantasy, whatever, I do love like those Georgian townhouses that you get with like the casement windows and stuff like that. And especially if they've still got like the original flooring. So you know that that's old wood and it's sort of like warped a bit with time, but it's withstood everything that history's thrown at it. Like I really, really love that. But I think if we're saying like dream house, right, because I also said feasibility, no object, so that would mean that I could somehow live in Mexico City while still working in London. I think what I love about the modernist houses that you find in Mexico City, those modernist buildings, is the use of colour. People often think of modernism as just like grey concrete. And obviously there's a lot of concrete, but it doesn't have to all be grey. So one of my favourite architects is called Luis Barragan, and he's sort of famous in Mexico for a lot of the most, you know, exciting, colourful houses and monuments and stuff like that. And so you'll find in his houses, like, you know, a massive pink wall, or like really bright blue or like bright yellow, bright green, which when you've got like the contrast of the concrete and like an emphasis on like horizontal lines, I just think stunning, stunning, stunning. And I also love in Marseille, an architect called Le Corbusier, who's like the father of modernism. He designed, you know, a famous housing block called Cité Radieuse. And what I love about it is that it's just this big fucking hulking like spaceship rectangle made of concrete when you look at it straight on. And then you look from the side and in the indents, like to the windows, they're all painted in like red, yellow, blue, green, and brown. So from the side, you look and it looks like a Mondrian painting. So yeah, big colourful modernism is my shit. And that's what I felt so excited thinking about. Question two, what's your favourite train journey?
So hard. That I've taken or that I want to do?
Either.
That I've taken is one I've talked about briefly before, which is a train journey from Vienna to Zurich in order to get a connecting train down to Florence. And I mean, every train journey I'm on, I love, because I love, I think this is not like a revolutionary or original thing to say, because like everyone loves a train journey. Everyone's like, wow, I'm on my way somewhere. I'm going to a destination, but there's a long way to go. So I can sit out the window and ponder and think about how much life is happening to me right now. But this train journey, I specifically booked it. Like I went a certain route past Innsbruck, or Innsbruck, I might be pronouncing that wrong. So, and it goes through the like the bottom of the Swiss mountains. I think they are the Alps. they are the Alps.
Yeah.
Goes to the bottom of the Alps, and you just go past like the lakes and the mountains. And it was midsummer, so they were at their luscious and most beautiful and green and blue, and the colours were so vivid. Every time I looked out the window, it's just like a camera, or my camera at least, on my phone would never be able to capture the depths of it. And there's almost a relief in that. There is a real relief in knowing that your phone camera won't be able to capture it. So take one video just for posterity and then put it the fuck away and just feast on what you are seeing and how alive you're feeling right now. That was a really good train journey. But there's also loads of train journeys I've taken where it's like I remember going through Rajasthan in India, and it's just like the ability to look out and just see everything at once and compare in your head, like in that area of like northern India, what I noticed so much compared to Britain is how outside everyone is. Like life is lived outside, and I don't mean that people don't have houses, of course they have fucking houses, but like it's such a communal sort of like you're in the streets, you see everything that's going on, it's really exciting. Or even the train journey that I took down to, where was I going? Rome, I think. No, I was going to Pompeii. I was going from Rome to Pompeii, and the Queen died while I was on the train. And I was like, we got stuck as well outside for ages, and I was just like, you will never forget where you were when the Queen died, which is on this very hot train where one of the carriages had broken aircon, so we all had to be moved out of it, in the middle of the like Roman countryside, the outskirts of Rome, going down to Pompeii, and you're just like soaked in this ancient history. And then like this head of this really old institution had also just like perished.
Perished.
There's just so many memorable train journeys. I fucking love a train journey. I could tell you about the journey that was meant to be 4 hours that turned into the nightmare journey from hell that I took recently back from Glasgow to London, which ended up going back to Carlisle. Then I had to go to Newcastle. That's memorable for different reasons. So there's so many. I love trains, and I love the stories you tell yourself about who you are and where you're going and who everyone else is while you're on the train. What about you?
I fucking love train journeys. So this was a question that was prompted because I had to go to Edinburgh for work at the weekend. And there's that stretch between Berwick-upon-Tweed and Edinburgh where you've got the sea to the right of you, which I believe is east, but never eat shredded. I actually did well in geography GCSE, but like obviously all of that just like fled. And I love that you, I don't know why this happens, but suddenly you are, you don't just, you're like, oh yeah, I've crossed the border into Scotland. It looks completely different. There's a kind of, you know, rather than like smooth rolling hills, there's a sort of ruggedness, like, you know, all of a sudden, and you can, you know, see heather and stuff like that. And there's, you know, a sort of like sprinkling of purple, like, you know, across the grass that you can see. And it just looks and feels so different, like immediately. And I don't know if it's because my mind plays a trick on itself and it goes, ah, you're in Scotland, so you're looking for something to hang a sense of Scottishness onto. But I am always really overwhelmed by that feeling when I take that journey. But I think maybe my favorite, you know, I think you're right to say that train journeys, there's something inherently memorable about them, even if they're not great. Like I remember getting a train from Tangier to Marrakesh overnight, and it was, they wouldn't let me and my partner sleep in the same sleeping compartment, so we're like, well, fine, we'll just sit in the upright one, and just it's fine. Like it would be, I didn't want to miss out the experience of a long train journey with him, so we're sitting there. But because they were like, you two better not be up to anything, like every half an hour they'd like shine a torch in our eyes, like through the compartment glass, to make sure we weren't up to any funny business.
Must have looked very,
so
like,
yeah, there's like
horned up for them to keep doing that.
Oh my god. I was just like, hey, it's
like these two, keep an eye on these two.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, so yeah, every train journey is memorable. But last question, would you rather live in a world that's really, really, really technologically advanced? So teleportation, faster than light travel, that kind of thing, or one where magic is real?
Magic appeals to my sense of whimsy, but also anyone who's read any sort of magic fantasy knows that magic is all about balance. And I think there's so many people in this world who would not use magic as it's intended. Sorry, I'm getting really serious about the philosophy of magic. I'm just...
Sorry, I just started reading.
You know, if you said like use like the powers as intended, that would be fine. That would have gravitas, but you have to say the word magic. I just started reading Earthsea, and it's like any book in that vein teaches, like Diana Wynne Jones, or even when Neil Gaiman gets all the magic, like any sort of magic fantasy book is all about when someone upsets the balance that magic has in the world, and how, you know, you still have to obey the laws of nature in some ways. Like you summon something, it means that somewhere else is getting deprived of something. You create something out of nothing that doesn't matter, because it's not actually something out of nothing. Something else is being taken in order to create that thing. There is, like, magic has rules and limitations the same way as everyone else. And I just think this, the individualism of our world means the way that we would use magic would be so damaging. I think the it would be a scorched earth immediately. We talk about nukes, imagine magic. So I think our world is probably set up better to use something like teleportation more responsibly, as mad as that sounds. I think magic is just, there's just so much power. I really am taking this quite seriously.
No, good. It's, you know, it's a question that is meant to be taken seriously.
I think I would choose teleportation and the technologically advanced, because I do think overall that might do slightly less damage, because our world is set up more to have an understanding of that. Whereas I think if magic just came into the world, I just don't think we would use it responsibly. And I worry about, yeah, I worry. And yeah, I think let's go teleport. Also, because
the thought of people having access to magic, it really keeps you up at night.
It's bothering me thinking about it. I'm thinking about, like, oh my God, imagine if like Netanyahu had access to magic. That was like, this is serious shit. Like, don't fuck with the magic. Teleportation, however, I think there's more of a democratic balance to the way that can be used. And I think, you know, there's powers shared out almost. Whereas with magic,
I completely agree.
Yeah, with magic, it's like, again, it's really individual. Like one person can hoard all the knowledge, or like you go to the magic school and it's like the Oxford of magics and only certain people allowed in there. Whereas teleportation, I do think there'll be more of like a state driven, here's all our teleport pods.
I think you're right. Like for me, the reason why I choose technologically advanced is because every fantasy work shows that there is an uneven distribution of magic. So not everyone has the same access to magic. Whereas in Star Trek, which I love watching Star Trek so much. The thing about the technology is that it's democratically distributed. And the point about the United Federation of Planets is that they've gone beyond scarcity. And they don't even have money. And so there is a motivation of, you know, intrinsic value to things, the intrinsic value of exploration, which isn't based on conquest. And actually the characters, or the races, it's kind of race, it's very speciesist. But like the alien races, which are motivated by a conquest or by money. So like, you know, the Romulans or the Ferengi, they're seen as being less developed in some ways, as being more worthy of derision.
Well, this is what Le Guin like writes about quite a lot. And actually, because I'm reading Earthsea after I've read her books, which are sci-fi, then there's a real contrast to the way the societies are set up and the possibility of what the societies are. And like when you're reading Le Guin, where it's like the technology is the thing that is the advanced stuff and different to our world, there is different types of society realized. And there's, you know, there's still capitalist societies, but there's also like fully anarchist societies, and this is the range of societies that you see are different, and there's more possibilities opened up. It is more democratic in that sense, and like the technology has changed what is possible, and they have created, like, you know, as you put it, the intrinsic value of like exploration, the intrinsic value of like knowledge for knowledge's sake, rather than now when it's all about like profit and gain. Whereas Earthsea, which I've just started, is just like about, I guess, individual quests and choice and journey, which is still very entertaining, but like I would definitely choose, yeah, technology. And this is we've now got a new sort of axis, I guess, which is magic versus technology. And we can somehow, let's work on that and make it into something where someone's like, are you a wizard or are you, I don't know what a technology, what was
Captain Picard?
Yeah, are you, da-da, da-da. Okay, let's workshop that, bank that for future apps.
Let's move on to your big theory.
Oh, yeah, it's my go, isn't it? I've got a big theory that I have partly lifted. Credit where it's due. 3 years ago, I read this piece by Clive Martin, who you might recognize his name. He was the former vice anthropology. Former vice king of anthropology. And he would document stuff like lad culture in the 2010s. Clive was like a very big influence on me wanting to get into journalism, I remember. But the piece I read most recently was in The Face magazine, and it was in, I think, 2021, and it was titled, Is Britain Entering an Age of Aggravation? I think about this piece so much because Clive basically outlines this opinion that Britain is broiling with new levels of rage and violence. And he cites these different sort of outlets for it or examples, which both come from civilian quarters, but also come from the state. So, you know, like, fights on a petrol shop forecourt, or arguments in coffee shop queues, and people kicking off at the theatre, but it also ranges up to like knife crime and like the epidemic of violence against women. And he attributes all of this rage and violence that we're seeing to the impact of austerity and like the divisive politics from the top. And he's not equating like a fight on the forecourt with what's happening to women at like such a high rate in terms of domestic violence or just like stranger violence, but he thinks they're connected. And I agree. I think when you're out in public in Britain, there are these new waves of hostility and suspicion that you can feel emanating from your fellow world travellers that weren't there before. Tempers are much shorter, but like I remember like when this piece came out, I'd just been to a climate protest where I'd gone into a pub and like three different people called me a cunt for having a climate sign just from sitting at their seats in the pub. And I also at the time was with someone who'd done some protesting recently, and they like had got kicked by passers-by. And I don't think, it's not a new thing that protesters are under attack, but this idea of civilians like getting out of their cars to kick people was really just stark and jarring to me. And, you know, I heard, my hairdresser the other day was telling me a story about how they tried to give someone a book on the tube because they thought they were looking at it. They're like, oh, do you want to read this book? And they were verbally attacked. They were like, you fuck, this person, like, you fucking can't, like, just out of the blue, out of nowhere, just because they were like drunk and a bit aggy. It was really odd. And I've also noticed this anger in myself. Like when I'm out walking, I'd be like, fuck off in my head. Just like random strangers or like the slightest thing, the slightest issue or obstacle in my way is like, for fuck's sake. Like there's this broiling rage and suspicion that I just have when I encounter people where I'm like, and I have to do the opposite action. Like I'm forcing myself to smile at people to try and like prove to myself that there is a way of like rebuilding these levels of trust and not just like seeing everyone around me as, you know, a threat or suspicious. But I can't work out whether that's just because I've lived in London for 11 years and you just become an angry person when you live in London. So my big theory is basically that Britain is getting angrier. And firstly, do you agree? And if so, why do you think that is?
Yeah, so I was having a think about this because I was trying to, in my head, go, well, how would you prove or disprove this either way? So when it comes to rates of violent crime, like historically, they're lower now than they used to be. So, you know, there was, and that can have, you know, little peaks and, you know, little falls like year to year, but the overall trend is that it's going downwards. Things which can have an impact on violent crime, Margaret Thatcher's economic reforms of the 1980s, which really broke up and dispersed communities because when the factories and the pits closed, people moved away and what was left was just sort of like, you know, hopelessness and a lot of men who were unemployed disproportionately impacted men. And that had an impact on violent crime. So it wouldn't surprise me if the consequences of austerity, increased sense of precarity, less of a sense of like permanence and rootedness and community have an impact on people being more violent or more angry or less trusting. So those are two things which I'm trying to like square in my head is like how this theory sits against the overall downward trend of violence. I think when it comes to what you were talking about, like agginess that you get on the street and agginess that you get in random places. I maybe have like a really romanticized view of where I live because even if something happens, like the other day, me and a woman collided into each other at the tube station and she fell over and she just went nuts at me. She was like, you're ignorant. People like you need to be educated. And I was like, wow, the racismo all of a sudden. And I was like, we just knocked into each other. And she was accusing me of having broken her phone, but like her phone was fine. I think she may have had some other things going on. I think she may have been like a bit mentally unwell. But even though that happened, I still have this overall view of like, you know, I'm like wandering around my neighborhood being like, you know, ah, sun is in the sky, the, you know, birds are tweeting, the trees are swaying, you know, I maybe have a very romanticized view of it. I wonder if one of the things is proximity, which is, you know, especially when you live in cities, there's a sort of like cheek by jowlness, like people are rubbing up against each other, like it causes friction. And then when the media is trying to make you as angry as possible at people. So you've got certain kinds of people who are held up as hate figures, and those people are very often protesters or people who are seen as being on the left, people who are like, you know, pro-Palestine or anti-climate change. You know, they're held up as public nuisances. And I think that this is something which is really like deeply English, which is you can't and shouldn't do anything to, I guess, take on those who are in power, right? But you should be empowered to enact the death penalty for causing some kind of public nuisance. Like we've got such a low cultural tolerance for nuisance or noise or disruption. And so an obvious way in which that plays out, and in a way that's been like totally egged on by the press, is like how people treat like, you know, Just Stop Oil protesters, or like Insulate Britain, like, you know, coming out and like dragging people around by their hair, or like, you know, ramming your SUV into them because you've been told that these people are lower than vermin. You know, another example is like back in November when Suella Braverman was like whipping up all this hatred against Palestine protesters. My mom, who is like, you know, a South Asian woman, like, you know, in her 60s, she got attacked on the tube home because the figure of the pro-Palestine protester was set up as a kind of hate figure. So that's one way in which it plays out, which is, you know, media sets people up as hate figures. And then if you are like white, male, middle-aged, you feel kind of like deputized to like rid the streets of this public nuisance. But like another way in which it plays out is like, so the area of London that I live in, like lots of areas of London, is in the process of gentrifying. And there's such a massive social cultural divide between the people who've lived here for a really long time, working class, people of colour, lots of people who are African and Caribbean, and the racial and class demographics of gentrifiers. This is a story which plays out all around the country. And I think this might have been last summer or the summer before. Like a thing that happens every summer is that people set up sound systems, right? And they set up sound systems and they drink some beers and they like smoke some weed. And I really fucking love it. I'm like, it's sound system season, baby. I love it. And the neighborhood group chat was like popping off. And people were like, you know, it was like 4 p.m. and people were like, I've called the police now. Have you done it? Like, we should all put the complaints in now. And I was like, what the fuck? It's the weekend. It's a sound system. I'm not in the neighborhood group chat because I don't want people to have my number or like work out where I live. But my partner was like, very politely, but sort of saying like, well, isn't this why we all want to live here? Like, this is the sort of like longstanding cultural identity of the place. And he didn't call anyone racist, but he was sort of making it known that it was kind of fucked up for like white gentrifiers to like call the police on like black people running sound systems. And everyone fucking went for him. They like took his head off because the principal was like, well, they're causing a public nuisance, so anything is justified. So yeah, that's a really like long-winded way of not answering your question about, is Britain entering an age of aggravation? Because I think that there are like lots of factors, but I think that low tolerance for what is considered a public nuisance is just such a big part of it. And then we all go on holiday to like Spain or Italy and we're like, oh my God, people are having so much fun. Why can't that be us? Well, like, higher tolerance for public nuisance. That's one reason.
I think, I mean, all your points are really good about this idea of public nuisance. But I think this, when I talk about this age of aggravation, I think it goes beyond anyone causing a public nuisance. I think it's just the idea of people existing around you in their own way. And I think since the pandemic, there's been like a notable breakdown in the sort of like grace and respect we afford to other people. And I think also the polarization of politics has created like this climate suspicion. For example, I was on a train the other day. We love trains. And I
We love trains.
And this was a really memorable train journey because I moved seats and asked this lady, could I sit there? And she was like, yeah. And we end up in a 2-hour conversation about like everything. And I won't go into the details because it's a private conversation that we had on the train. But I think if we met in other circumstances, or she'd known like what I'd do first or something like that, she probably would have viewed me with suspicion, or like I was about to judge her. And like, we wouldn't have been able to have this open, honest conversation where I could make it clear from the get-go that just because, you know, I'm working at a left-wing media outlet doesn't mean that I'm going to come in guns blazing and be like, this, I'm going to tell you this. But instead, we had like a really great, just like long chat about our lives and like our beliefs in politics and stuff like that. But I think because we know that politics is polarized and everyone's kind of like, I think there's been an entrenchment of right-wing views. But people are really scared that their neighbor's going to judge them. You know, this idea of don't judge thy neighbor. Everyone judges thy neighbor now. And I think when we meet the neighbors, there's this preemptive sort of defensiveness. The hackles are up, like, you know, don't judge me, you don't know my life, et cetera, et cetera. And I hear this a lot from people. But I think it also just extends to like the amount, it's tolerance, but I don't think it's tolerance of public nuisance, it's just tolerance and like empathy and compassion for other people around us that we just don't extend. Everyone's in the fucking way. Get out of my way, move out of my fucking way, like the Rihanna thing, you know? Everyone's in the fucking way, whether that's conceptually or whether that's literally. And I just see this so much. It's like at festivals, people that, you know, if you bump into, once upon a time, you just smiled and laughed and been fine. Now it's like, dirty look. Or you're in a queue and someone's being noisy and it's just like, fuck off. Even though in the past you've been like, woo. And I'm training myself out of like even thinking that, because I think it's just such a dark-minded place to go to where everyone else around you is like just in the fucking way all the time. But I see this in other people, and like people voice it to me. And I don't know, it's just this aggravation, this low-level irritant. And I do wonder, like, you know, Clive Martin said it's because of this austerity and this divisive politics. I also wonder if it is like the retreat. I mean, I think this is all linked, like our economic world feeds down to all of the social stuff. But I think the pandemic as well, when we were retreated to our homes and we had complete, in some cases, complete control of our surroundings, or the illusion of control for once. Now it's like you have to go and live in society again. It's very difficult. But then I see people behaving in ways which are fucking annoying. Like, you know, when you go to concerts, for some reason, TikTok trends mean that everyone's screaming. Why are you screaming? Why can't you just sing the words? Why are you screaming like this to every song? That fucking annoys me. Well, see, I'm aggravated and hot. I'm hot-headed.
I don't know. I also remember like in the early 2000s, this sort of like trend of like, you know, TV programs called Grumpy Old Men, when they'd get like, you know, Paul Merton and like, you know, Jeremy Clarkson to just like complain about the things which annoyed them in society, which was inevitably working class people doing things, or women, or just women doing women things. So I kind of think that that's been a cultural mainstay for like quite some time. And also like not forgetting that what happened in the early 2000s was the introduction of antisocial behavior orders. So the criminalization of non-criminal acts. So if there were too many teenagers gathered looking suspicious, that was a cause for the police to intervene in some way. So I think that that has been part of this like cultural shift. So when you're lowering the tolerance for what's considered a nuisance to people just existing or being around, like that invites a culture of suspicion. And I think you're right to think about what the pandemic did to us, which is it made us mistrustful of other people, because if other people got too close, they were a potential source of infection that would put you at risk and your household at risk and your family at risk. You know, it's very much like stay back, stay back. And I remember like in the very, very early days where it was, I think, a couple of days before lockdown. And what happened was that I'd gone to the office to collect a load of stuff so that, you know, when the lockdown eventually came, I could work from home. And there were these like two like young people in their 20s on a date, and they had their feet right up against like the opposite hand pole. So it wasn't just the opposite seat, but the opposite hand pole. And I remember telling them off for it. And I remember being like, you know, there's a communicable disease around, don't you know? Even though that wasn't transmitted by feet as far as I know. But there was something about it which like, really riled me up. And I was just like, this is like a proximity and like a recklessness and a lack of consideration that I don't like. And it definitely made me aggravated. And, you know, the pandemic invited us to like really, really, really police how people were in public space. And then it also created this idea that our homes were the only safe place over which we had like freedom and a sense of like sovereignty. And thinking about how we negotiate between freedoms and public space, it just became so, so zero sum. Like, it's this or this, you know, it's my rights versus your rights. And I think that we're there in a big way, but almost every society has changed in some way because of the pandemic. Like, you know, you go to Spain and people say, oh, but people do drink less in the street than they used to before the pandemic. You know, some things never came back, but there was a pretty strong foundation of like, conviviality and like being outside and like what it meant to be outside. So even though it didn't come back to being the exact same way as it was, like it's still a lot more like convivial and social and outdoors than the UK. But in the UK, it's like we have so much suspicion towards other people, like culturally, like, you know, we're a very curt and twitchy people. And then we like added to that, like Asbos, and then like we added to that, like lockdown. And we have a media culture which sets up people as hate figures, particularly if like, you know, they're seen to have an inflated sense of their own morality. That's why people really hate climate protesters and protesters of all kinds. It's like, you think you're better than me, don't you?
Yeah. And
therefore I should murder you.
Therefore I'm going to run you over with my SUV. Yeah. And I think the level of constant surveillance is also there too, because it's like, you can be judge, jury and executioner on someone else's behavior via the little black screen in your pocket. Like if someone's, you know, someone's just existed in public or is annoying you in some manner and you're aggravated by that, either you can film it and it might be generally like abusive behavior or something. I'm not talking about that here. But either way, you can film what's happening. You can film someone and capture it and then repurpose that footage in whatever way you please. You could either present it as it happened accurately, or you can attach it to, cut it up and attach to a narrative, not to be all conspiratorial. Or you can simply turn your phone on you and retell the story of how you experienced those events in the way you want, entrenching, you know, your perception of how this encounter has gone and probably getting a lot of reinforcement and validation for the way that you feel about it online. So, you know, you can be like, it was so fucking annoying. This person did this or that, or like this flight attendant did this and it was really irritating. And some people be like, you're a heinous person. Like, how can you treat a service worker like that? And some people be like, no, flight attendants should do this. Uber drivers is a good example of this. You know, the constant debate over, my Uber driver's talking to me, it's really annoying. I'm actually like neurodivergent and it's a bit abusive. And there's like the camp who are like, yes, this is totally valid and a great way to treat other people in this world. And the other camp, which is so horrified by the way that we've reduced, you know, language around accessibility, or where we've repurposed language around accessibility into, you know, underpinning these really horrible clinical ways of interacting with other people, especially service workers. So I think the phone element and the element of being able to film and surveil and then reframe a narrative, how you see it, to transmit to everyone else for their approval, is also quite interesting, and how aggravated we are by people around you. And also maybe in our heads when we're going about, there's also that element of like, how would this story be when I tell it? How will this story be recounted when I tell it to other people? I think content that is negative in flavor, or we talk about something we're irritated by, always goes so much further than something we're like, this is amazing and I'm so happy about this thing, and like, oh, I had this amazing day. It's just less interesting. That's why we talk about bad dates all the time, or you know, bad experiences with bosses, because it just goes 10 times further and is much richer for us to pick over. Difficult things are richer for our inner monologues, I believe.
But there's a difference between content and conversation, right? So content that goes further is like, this heinous thing happened to me, and like, oh my God, like, you know, it is about stimulating the emotion of like anger or disgust or condemnation. But when someone talks like that all the time, they're the most boring fucker on the planet. I'm like, I don't want to be around you. And I was thinking about this because my housemate just got back from a 3.5 week chaos holiday. So him and another friend who is like similarly a king of chaos. I would say not similarly, he's like the grand emperor of chaos, and that's like one of the great things about him. And I think also he's able to be this way because he has absolutely no digital footprint whatsoever. He's like an American anarchist who loves nothing more than like street drinking and like fighting cops. Like he's just a fucking hilarious guy. So the two of them like went on this holiday where they were just like getting like fucking totaled every day, and like on lots of trains and ferries and doing everything the long way. And it was a combination of, I think, their openness to experience, and also because they were like just two guys getting trashed, which is sort of like, you know, it's like a catalyst for like stuff happening. Yeah. Like when you're like that fucking wasted, just stuff will happen. And so like, my housemate came back and like, you know, it was me, him and my husband having dinner last night. And we were just like enthralled by his storytelling. And we would literally be like, another one, tell us another story. And so like one would be this like crazy ferry that they got from Italy to Barcelona, and like, you know, the guy who ran the bar, and like, you know, they didn't book sleeping cabins, so they like just slept out on the deck and like just tried drinking for as long as they could. Like, the thing which made it entertaining was chaos, right? Like, it was the fact that they sort of like took a risk of being nuisances themselves, and also like were engaging with other people who were nuisances on a basis of like, yeah, this is fun, like, let's fucking go. How would that have been as content? I'm not sure. Maybe like a podcast where it's like, yeah, telling wild stories, fine. Maybe it wouldn't do so well. It certainly wouldn't go so well, like, in terms of the way in which the algorithm rewards outrage. But as conversation, as something to be around, like, I felt like it was, you know, 1001 Arabian Nights, but like on a ferry. Like, I was like, tell me another one.
Yeah.
So yeah, like, what our system of content creation rewards is not the same thing as conversations you want to be a part in.
Not to get all deep and serious, but I do want to push back slightly on this idea of being open to chaos as the means to being happier, because I think a lot of the time chaos, it's synonymous with the idea of drinking and being out of control. Whereas I think that is something I see a lot in like my friends and people I love. And I don't think the idea of their perception of chaos actually brings them like a lot of sadness and uncertainty and worry. And what I want to pin down here is like what he was open to was connection with people that were outside maybe his expectations. And yeah, it's like
maybe
flexibility for experience. But I don't want it just to be like, we fetishize chaos so much. We fetishize the messy person, the XYZ person. But I know those people, and like, they all had to go into recovery, and it was really long and fucking sad. And I feel like I feel like I experience life so much, and I connect with all these mad mental people in a great way that's exciting. But it can be chaotic, but can also just be about that idea of like being open to connection that you haven't planned for.
I guess the reason why I use the word chaos, it's not necessarily just about booze, though. Of course, like, you know, with these two lads on their holiday, it was a lot about booze. I guess by talking about chaos, I'm talking about not leading with, is this a threat?
Yeah.
And I actually have like a crazy, like, you know, I would say a disproportionately big threat detector. And so I'm trying to find ways to like turn it down and like turn it off, because, you know, I really enjoy chaos, or I have really enjoyed chaos, and I kind of want a bit more of it. I think that's the place I'm speaking from, which is I want to have less of a threat detector.
I think you just define everything that's outside of your normal parameters of control as chaos. And I think that's actually something. I think it's just about our definitions of what chaos are.
Next episode.
But let's move on to our dilemmas, because as always, we've yapped. We've yapped more than we were allowed to yap. First dilemma, do you want to read it out?
I do want to read it out. So, first dilemma. Hi, I'm a 20-year-old male uni student. I have a close-knit group of friends who I've known for nearly 2 years, but we've only become really close in the last year. When I first met one member of the group, I flirted quite heavily with him. I didn't realise we would go on to be friends, and he had a girlfriend at the time. The desire faded as we became platonic friends, but since he became single again, I've developed a crush. I don't want to act on it because we have a good friendship, both one-on-one and in a group, and if it were to go badly, I fear it would ruin what we have, and frankly, I don't think a relationship is likely to happen. With this in mind, I want to stop having this crush and see him as I do the rest of my friends. How do I do this, or should I try to pursue the romantic path?
Ash, you know the drill. You read it. You gotta go first.
Oh, okay. I mean, for me, one of the like key bits of context here is that you're 20 and you're at uni. And one of the great things about that time is the intensity of connection. I feel very nostalgic when I read this dilemma, because that feeling of like sweet, sweet agony, like, ah, hook it to my veins. It makes me feel so alive. Like, you know, you make your playlist, you feel your feelings. And I think that my advice for someone who's 20 and at uni, I think it's a bit different from the advice that I'd give to someone who's like in their 30s. The point of being at uni and the point about being in this context is that you feel very intense things. And what they settle down into, you know, not after 2 years of friendship, but 5 years of friendship, 10 years of friendship, it'll be different. So I kind of think you don't have to be in a rush to stop having this crush. You can let it move through you. You can sort of experiment a little bit with what it might mean to act on it, to like flirt a bit more, or to like, you know, even raise it and say, yeah, I've got a bit of a crush on you. Because this is really the time to do that. You know, you've got a lot less to lose than where you end up a bit later. And I'm not saying you should, you know, fetishize being like really destructive within a friendship group, or, you know, let go of a sense of responsibility completely. But you're not going to be this unencumbered ever again. There's only going to be more, I don't know, encumbrances, is that a word? Even more responsibilities, even more things that you feel that you can't disrupt or trouble. And yeah, now's the time to feel shit.
Ash, what advice would you give? Can I just say, because I know so many people in their 30s who have crushes of this vein. So I think it would be useful to know what the difference in your advice would be as well to someone who's older. Because I know our listeners will be like, bitch, tell me the advice for me.
Okay, so my advice would be similar in the sense of going, let the crush move through you. There's no point in trying to repress it. The only way to deal with a crush is through, you know, you have to feel the feelings. How you act on it would be a different consideration. It would be much more about like, okay, well, can the context that you're in survive and recover from like a little period of awkwardness or a little period of you guys not seeing each other if it doesn't go wrong. When it comes to like a declaration of feelings, I would say really try and read the situation first before doing it. There'd be just a bit more emphasis on responsibility, reading of the situation than there is for someone who's 20 and at uni. But the fundamental thing of like, let the crush move through you, that still stands.
Just thinking about the original, I mean, I love letter writer that you're listening to this at 20. Hello, hi, I hope you're having fun, because university can be really fun, but I promise you as well, the biggest fun is yet to come. So like Ash says, this is the most unencumbered you will be, but it is also like you are young and you're at the beginning of your journey and there is so much else waiting for you out there too. And, you know, maybe you will crush on this guy and you might tell him and you might reciprocate and you might end up being in a relationship for 20 years, but you also might crush on him and in 10 years you'd be like, who the fuck is that? Like, I don't know who that is at all. And you look at his Instagram and he's lost all his hair and he doesn't look good with it like some men do because he doesn't have the bone structure. And like, wow, that was crazy. Remember university when I used to fancy that guy? Because that's what happened to me. that's basically what happened to me. I think it's hard because like, when you're in a crush, you feel like you will never leave the crush. It's like having a cold. You can't remember what it's like to breathe unencumbered.
Through
both nostrils.
It's like, at the same time.
What is it like to not fancy this person so much? And there's a peak of a crush as well when you just feel absolutely bonkers. And it's like you're fantasizing all the time. And it's a fever. It's like a fever. Like, oh my God. Like, oh, everything's like about this. So, oh, they've DM'd me again. Oh, they've liked my photo on Instagram. Ah.
Yeah, your nervous system is on fire. You know what I mean?
And it's fun. It's fun wallowing in that, unfortunately. Like, it feels unbearable, but in a like a good way. Do you actually want to stop having this crush, or, well, we want to, when we're crushing, it's like when we think there's no way out, we say we want to stop. It's like, do you actually want to stop, or do you actually want kind of permission to either say something or just kind of like explore those feelings further? Because in this letter you haven't said anything about him like not reciprocating or not flirting back. You haven't said anything that would imply that he's not being receptive to this like sort of behavior. It takes two to tango usually with a crush. There's usually some sort of like egging on, but you also don't think a relationship would happen. Do you even want a relationship, or do you just want to, you know, jump his bones? That's another question. What would happen if you just end up hooking up? I don't know. See him as the rest of my friend. How do I do this? Should I try and pursue the romantic path? I kind of think you should give yourself a timeline. You should give yourself like 2 months And if in 2 months the crush is not abated, you haven't been icked out, you haven't, you know, started crushing on someone else or found someone else that actually is less complicated and satisfies those feelings that you're having, then maybe you have a little chat. Maybe say, you know what? I kind of fancy you and there's a tension between us and I don't know what I want from this, but I want to tell you because it's not going away. That's my advice.
I think that nothing will change in 2 months unless something changes. And the reason why I say that is because, like, this can sound incredibly pretentious, but I think it's from... Antony and Cleopatra is she makes hungry where most she satisfies. The more you're in proximity to this person, the more you want them. And the thing that will change that is like distance and maybe you meeting someone else like within the context of that distance and separation.
You've forgotten a key thing here, Ash. University. 2 months.
God, that's a lifetime, isn't it?
It's some holidays.
8 weeks is a lifetime when you're 20.
I mean, you might still be hanging out in the same city, but I'm just saying, it's the summer holidays and I feel that there will be distance there that you can create.
Yeah. I mean, and things might be very, very different in those 2 months if there is that distance. I just sort of think that, yeah, like fucking roll the dice. You're 20, roll the dice.
I'm just thinking about this because I'm like, I've never in my life really heard of like a good... It's like this, we talked about spots recently, spots, solutions for getting rid of spots. It's the same thing with crushes. It's literally just time, I'm afraid. It's time and either you end up, you know, telling your crush and something happens and it might blow up your life or it might not. Or you end up not saying anything and it fades because the crush was born out of something that wasn't substantial enough to like last. But there is no other way through but time. There is no quick fix. There is no pseudocreme. Pseudocreme's a myth. It's just a placebo.
There's no pseudocreme. There's no pseudocrush.
There's no pseudocrush. And on that note... No? Ash, that's over you, Jamie.
What is on that note?
I was like, on that note, where's your telepathy? You said you were telepathic.
I aim for telepathy. No, okay. The reason why I long paused was... Should we just cram in another dilemma?
Okay, we can. I meant to finish. Yeah, we can. Fuck it. Why not? Guys, we're back. Guys, we just tricked you into thinking we're going, but we're coming back. Okay, let's do another dilemma. Let's do it. Okay, shall I read it out?
Read it out so quickly.
No, we're not doing TikTok 1.5 speed. I'm gonna respect our audience. Ready? We're doing a double uni dilemma because we've decided we need to feed y'all. We need to feed y'all little youngins a little bit more. So, dilemma two. Hoping for some help with this complicated friendship breakup dilemma. I have a friend I met at university. She's always been wonderful and introverted, so despite having established our friendship at uni, we maintained a close one-to-one friendship after. For most of the time I've known her, she's been in a relationship with a great guy. A year and a bit ago, they introduced me to this guy, her boyfriend's best friend, and housemate. We hit it off immediately. At first, my friend was really excited about it, but after my new relationship was clearly serious, the friend became really distant. She left if I was in the room and stopped replying to me. I continued to try and ask her to hang out, but after a while it came to a head and we had a direct conversation when she said she didn't want to be friends anymore. She said the change in our dynamic of our friendship because of our boyfriends being best mates is irreversible and she can't see how we can have a friendship. It was also because it's triggered her anxiety so badly. She said it was fine because we would still see each other in group settings. This made me very upset. I didn't have any choice but to accept it. It's been a year now. We both live with our boyfriends. In the same house? That's not answered. We both live with our boyfriends. We still see each other in group settings and I feel very uncomfortable. The friends are really lovely, but this is exacerbated by my feelings of being an outsider. But most importantly, I miss my friend. I don't know what to do. We've always been in each other's lives, but this feels like a shitty settlement. I'm also still hurt and not sure going to her directly and asking to be friends again might just make it worse. What do you think? What the fuck is your friend on? What's going on here? I think your friend has some serious issues with maybe control is what I'm kind of getting here. Like she wants to control the dynamics of the friendship and the idea that you now have a relationship to someone her boyfriend's connected to that is outside of her control and you're outside of her control having this relationship with someone else as well has really set off her anxiety. There's something there about control. And I've had, you know, some similar situations where it's like a connection to someone else who's been a mutual and then has become like a friend, had sort of people's control issues about not having direct, you know, influence over the way that relationship is conducted. So there's definitely something to me here about control. And she, you say she's directly communicating with you, but she's not, apart from expressing her, it's poor communication done directly, because she's expressing a decision she's already made without really unpicking why she's made it, and really her feelings about it. And she's like, it's changed our friendship, you know, irreversibly. It's changed the friendship because she's changed it. She was the one who changed the way your friendship has been conducting. She started ignoring you. She started leaving the room. There's something going on with her, but she's externalizing it to everyone else and taking herself away from the blame.
I've got a theory.
Go on, theory up.
Okay, right. This is a theory, and it stems from an observation that I have had, and also have been complicit in myself, which is sometimes when women fancy men, they introduce them to their friends, and there's sort of a bit of like a vicarious erotic thrill to doing that. And then if it becomes something serious and real, and most importantly, he's not rejecting the person that you introduced him to, there can be a component of jealousy and envy. And because we live in a culture where jealousy is so, so frowned upon, like it's not, you can't really look it in the eye without feeling that it makes you a bad person or a weak person or a morally compromised person. You repress it and you try and give it different names. So you say, oh, it's, you know, our dynamics changed. Or like, oh, this is like triggering my anxiety. But I think there is an element of erotic competition and jealousy. I don't think that this person maybe is someone you should be friends with. I understand that you miss them, but I don't think that this is necessarily someone you should be friends with. Not because they felt jealous, right? Jealousy, human emotion. And I think that, like, you know, some of the most refreshing conversations I've had with my female friends is when we're open about ways in which we feel jealous of each other or envious of each other, because there's some honesty there. It's when someone is feeling a sense of like ownership, feeling a sense of like jealousy or competition, and is making it your fault, that I don't think you should be friends with that person.
Yeah. And I think even if she doesn't, I think you are kind of right. I think you're kind of bang on the money with the erotic competition. I think even if she doesn't directly fancy this guy in an overt way that she's conscious of, there is clearly something here about competition and her being the center point on which everyone's revolving around. And that's no longer true when the you know, the relationships become parallel. And the men involved. And it's stuff she obviously hasn't worked out or been able to communicate to you as well. And I think one of the tests that I find, which is quite good, which has always comforted me, is that anytime I think I felt erotic competition with my friends or anything like that, which is very rare, luckily, because of the way we're set up, my instinct has always been to double down on like the love I'm expressing for my friends, and the love and the way that I talk about them becomes like even more glowing. So that makes me feel really comforted. It's like, pull them closer now. Like, do not go down this path, because it will end poorly. And it will end with you, you know, again, relying on the validation of like some random fucking man instead of these wonderful people around you. But yeah, erotic competition is something that, the erotic competition comes up a lot, because we live in a society that pits women against each other. Even if you don't fancy someone, erotic competition is such a fucking thing. And you will be thrown into those dynamics more than you realize, because as you say, we don't get to talk about jealousy a lot. And actually, this is very relevant, because Charlie XCX has just released an album all about, well, among other things, but like, which focuses a lot on the idea of like being a woman and grappling with jealousy, particularly in the music industry, but also in general, this idea of like being in competition with other women, and how as a woman, you know, you're expected to like instantly like everyone and be nice to everyone, but you also feel like these deep feelings of a deep awareness of the competition you're thrown in, and how you're expected to sort of like passive aggressively outdo other women. And you can't talk about that, because to talk about that would make you an absolute bitch.
Well, yeah, and also you can't say, hey, I think you might be jealous of me, because that sounds mental.
Yeah. like the one thing we can never do is accuse anyone else of being jealous of us. It's like the thing you cannot say is like, I think you're jealous of me, or I think there's jealousy here. Because then you are bigging yourself up to be someone better than, even though
you have to wait until someone says it about your situation. Yeah. You have to wait until someone goes, I think they're jealous of you. And then you've got to go, no, no, no.
Yeah, no. Because we can't talk openly about how everything around us is geared to make us jealous of each other. Everything around us is geared to make us feel like, you know, whether you're het or whether you are queer or whatever, it doesn't matter. You're still thrown into competition with other people, whatever gender you are. But with women, there's a particularly heightened one when it comes to sexual competition. And yeah, I see that, you know, like the way we talk about stuff.
And I just find it funny that, like, you know, sometimes when this happens, particularly like when there's a sort of like complicated thing about like women and men in friendship groups and there being this sort of like, you know, an erotic connection being expressed through like, I want to set you up with someone else, is that that's very, very difficult for men to perceive. They just sort of, they often don't get it. And when I've like described this to like some of my male friends, they're sort of a bit like, you know, they're a bit like Scooby-Doo. They're like,
yeah, they're like, what? And it's like, well, you know, someone's clearly, sometimes it is totally like altruistic. And it's like, no, I want to set you up because I think you get on really well. And sometimes there's this thing of like, as you say, vicarious, I see you as an erotic object and I'm going to put another person in front of you so I can kind of live through that. But if you don't reject her, I'm going to feel like shit.
Yeah.
Which is all plays into it.
We should do like a psychological warfare special, like all of the like weird little dynamics and tricks and, you know, bits of weaponry.
Yeah. I mean, that would be revealing some of the ugliest parts of myself. So maybe if people want that, they'll have to pay a large amount of money to access it. That should be the vault episode. And we should have like, okay, you can get this, but it will self-destruct after one listen and you will have to pay like £100
If you want access to the vault. All right. Should we wrap it up there?
Yeah, let's fucking do it.
Right.
So enthusiastic. Let's fucking wrap this up.
You're like, please free me from this torment. Let me go.
I was excited. I love beginnings. I love endings because it means a new chapter is starting.
I like the juicy, juicy middle.
Oh yeah. This is why we work though, Ash, because we bring what's the word? Not competing. Complementary perspectives. Anyway, I've been Moyle the McLean. You've been.
I've been Ash Sarkar. And what has this been?
This has been If I Speak. See you next week.
I think I know how you feel. It's so confusing sometimes to be